I'd like us to take our Bibles again this morning and turn to Matthew chapter 19. We began this series of messages in Genesis chapter 1. This is simply a reiteration by Christ of that passage. And since we'll be spending some time in this passage anyway, in this message, I'd like to again read here Matthew chapter 19, beginning with verse 4. Verse 4 it says, "And he answered and said, Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Consequently, they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. They said to him, Why then did Moses command to give her a certificate and divorce her? And he said to them, Because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it has not been this way." We'll look at more of that passage than just that, but I wanted to start with that again, putting the emphasis on the fact that God's design for man and woman, or at least for some, the majority, would be that they be husband and wife. The title of this series is Marriage, Divorce, and Remarriage. This will be part 3. In the first message of the series, I hopefully made it clear that this series is dedicated to the perpetuation of marriage and fidelity, although it is devoted to clearing up the misconceptions and false theology about divorce and remarriage. I want you to understand where the emphasis really is, and it needs to be there, obviously, from this passage itself. Yeshua, in this passage and in other ones found in the Gospels, clarifies what when it's looked at and under the right light, if you will, he clarifies what he means on the subject of marriage and divorce, but very clearly you can see where the emphasis is nonetheless, and that is again on the perpetuation of marriage and fidelity. In the last message we began to do just that, we began to clear up the misconceptions and false theology regarding divorce and remarriage as we examined it from the Old Testament passages which pertain to this particular subject. The majority of that message was directed at clarifying and distinguishing between the two Hebrew words translated divorce and put away in Deuteronomy chapter 24. As we clearly demonstrated, those two Hebrew words mean two different things and are not interchangeable terms under the Old Covenant. Now, with this and the other knowledge that we have gleaned from the God's law on this subject, let's see if we cannot make better sense of the New Testament passages which also deal with divorce and putting away. Let's begin with Matthew 5. However, don't turn there because we're not going to go there immediately. Before actually going to this first New Testament passage, it should first be understood that there are also two different words used in the Greek New Testament manuscripts for divorce and putting away as well, just as there were in the Hebrew Old Testament manuscripts. The word for put away in the Greek is apaluo, and the Greek word for divorce is apostasion. And as with the Hebrew word for divorce, the same is also true for the Greek word for divorce, in that it is a very specific term, and it as well is only used 3 times in the New Testament, just as the Hebrew word was used only in 3 different passages in the Old Testament. It also, as was the case in the Hebrew, is always found used in conjunction with the term or the word bill, certificate, or writ, depending again on what translation you may be using. As was the case with the Hebrew word for put away or send away, the same is also true for the Greek word in that it is, that's translated into the same term, in that it is also a very generic or common term. And in this case, in the New Testament, is used 68 times. Once again, one example will suffice to demonstrate that these two Greek words are no more interchangeable than were the two Hebrew words. putting away and divorce, in spite of the fact that in many cases or in many situations, especially in the New Testament, we find the translators seeming to interchange them when they cannot be. Turn to Matthew chapter 15 and we'll show by this passage that these two terms simply cannot be interchanged or cannot be translated either way. Matthew chapter 15 and verses 21 through 24. What we'll be centering in on in this case again is not the word divorce, apostasion, but the Greek word for put away, apoluo. Matthew chapter 15, and beginning with verse 21, it says, "And Yeshua went away from there and withdrew into the district of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a Canaanite woman came out from that region and began to cry out, saying, Have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed. But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came to him and kept asking him, saying, Send her away, for she is shouting after us." Verse 24, he then answers her. He says, "But he answered and said, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." So there's the context of the passage. It's in verse 23 that we actually find the Greek word apoluo. Verse 23, and it says, "But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came to him and kept asking him, saying, Send her away." Or let it be that she is sent away, you could say. That's the two words, send away there. That is translated from the Greek, properly, correctly translated from the Greek word apoluo. Now, if it could be, if apoluo in this particular passage could be translated as divorce, as the translators did in some other passages, then it would mean that Yeshua had been married to the Canaanite woman, because it would read, "But he did not answer her a word, and his disciples came to him and kept asking him, saying, Divorce her, for she is shouting after us." And obviously, that is not the case. Hardly the case that Yeshua was married to the Canaanite woman, especially with his words that follow when he tells her that he was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So you can see, just as clearly as we did under the Old Covenant, those two words are simply not interchangeable terms. Now, with this understanding about these two Greek words, let's examine the New Testament passages which use them, beginning with Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5 and the two verses 31 and 32. Verse 31 to begin. Verse 31, I'm reading from the New American Standard Version, and it says, "And it was said, Whosoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of dismissal." Now let's just stop there before we go to verse 32. You talk about turning things around and mixing them up. Never have I found a poorer translation of a verse, with the exception of the blatant removal of the tetragrammaton, or Yahweh's name from the Old Testament, and the transliteration of the Greek word baptizo into baptism in the New Testament. Outside of that exception, I don't think I've ever come across a poorer translation of a verse than what we find here. Even the New International Version has done a better job. I should have checked the Living Bible, because I rank it as the worst and NIV as probably the second worst. But even the NIV has done a better job than what the New American Standard in this case has been. And the New American Standard, in most cases, as far as an English translation, not the text from which it comes from. The King James, I think, probably, without question, is from the best text. But as far as a translation into English, with keeping in mind that sometimes the text needs to be referred to from the King James, I believe the New American Standard, at least for our day and age, is not only the most accurate, but renders, for our sake, a better understanding of the Greek. However, even the NIV, as bad as I think it is, and I think it's probably been a purposely corrupted version in many cases, as in Romans chapter 4 and verse 1 and others that I've pointed out to you previously. But even it has done a better job. Not much better, mind you, but still a better job. Here's how it reads. Matthew 5 and verse 31 reads in the NIV. It says, "It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce." The NIV, as has most of the other modern English translations, at least the ones that I checked out before while doing this message, have taken the two Greek words apoluo in this verse and apostasion and translated them both as divorce, as I just read to you in the NIV. However, the NASV, the New American Standard Version, has switched the two words. Now, I'm not sure which is worse, but they're both bad. Now, let me read it again from the New American Standard Version and then compare it with how it should be translated as found in the King James Version. The New American Standard Version again says, and it was said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of dismissal, or a certificate, another word for putting away or sending away. Whereas the King James, in comparison or contrast, renders it, quote, it has been said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement, end of quote. So you can see that just completely switched it around in the New American Standard. Only from the King James Version. Now, I didn't check every single English version there is, but in comparison to the ones that are best known, only the King James Version, in conjunction with God's law, can one come away with a correct understanding or a correct conclusion about what Yahshua is actually saying in this passage. In other words, from the King James and in conjunction with God's law. In other words, Yahshua is declaring that it is not permissible for someone to put away his wife without giving her a certificate of divorce, which is in perfect harmony with what we've read previously in Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verse 1. Going on now, Yahshua then declared in verse 32, he says, but I say to you that everyone, reading again from the New American Standard, but I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the cause of unchastity, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. I mentioned first, going on, Yahshua then declared in verse 32. Well, he declared no such thing. That's my point. The point is, he declared no such thing, at least as it is rendered in the New American Standard Version. If the NASV and other modern English versions are correct in how they rendered this verse, then Yahshua would have been guilty of heresy for changing God's law and would have been guilty of sin and couldn't be our Redeemer. That's how critical or how important it is that this passage be rendered correctly and be understood correctly. Don't forget what Yahshua himself declared just 13, 14, and 15 verses earlier. Look at Matthew chapter 5 and verse, beginning with verse 17. He said, as we pointed out earlier in another message, do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish or to change, you could say, but to fulfill. And then he says, for truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law until all is accomplished. Whosoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and so teaches others shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven, but whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Even in verse 18, if you take the position that all was accomplished at the cross, which indeed I don't believe is the case, but even if you take that position, you must understand that at this stage in Yahshua's ministry, he hadn't reached the cross yet. And so all hasn't been accomplished or fulfilled, even according to that interpretation of these passages. It still has to be accomplished. Thus the law, even at this point with that interpretation, cannot be said to have been fulfilled, and he could not have changed it. And if you interpret or if you translate the verse as the NASV does and many other modern translations, then you have Yahshua changing that law which he said he did not come to change or abolish. In the latter part of verse 32, as found in the New American Standard Version, it says, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Let me read it again. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Whereas God's law allowed for a properly or lawfully divorced woman to remarry. And that's where you come up with the problem with this translation as found in the New American Standard. The New American Standard would indicate that any woman who's divorced and remarries for any reason is committing adultery. That is simply not the case, at least according to God's law. God's law allowed for a properly or lawfully divorced woman to remarry as found in Deuteronomy 24. Let's turn back there. We've gone and used this passage two or three times already. But now we'll read the whole context of this passage. Rather than just verse 1, we'll read verses 1 through 4. Beginning in verse 1, it says, "When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because she has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she leaves his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, and if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it into her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband, who sent her away, is not allowed to take her again to be his wife, since she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before Yahweh, and you shall not bring sin on the land which Yahweh your God gives you as an inheritance." The only remarriage that is non-permissible or unlawful according to God's law is for a divorced woman to go back to a man she had previously been married to and divorced from. Otherwise, in this passage and in nowhere else in the Bible, is there any prohibition against a wife or a divorced woman from remarrying. Otherwise, outside of this particular situation, there were no limitations or restrictions on a divorced woman remarrying, other than, of course, that it be, first of all, in the Lord, since we're talking within the context of Christianity or the Scriptures or God's law, that it be with a man and not another woman, that it be of the same race and not from one of the forbidden lineages. Now, we're taking all of that for granted in the context here. But outside of what the context said here, there were no restrictions or prohibitions for a woman, except for this one, for a divorced woman to remarry. Now, with the law on divorce and remarriage being what it is, there must be something wrong with the modern English translator's rendering of Matthew chapter 5 and verse 32, and indeed there is. Nowhere in this verse, in the original language, can the Greek word for divorce, apostasion, be found. It's simply not there in those verses. Instead, it's the Greek word apoluo that is used. Once again, the King James has rendered it correctly. Matthew 5 and verse 32, where it says, "But I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causes her to commit adultery." Using the word put away for apoluo as it should be, rather than the word divorce. Now we can understand what Yeshua was saying, and rather than being in contradiction with the law, he is in perfect harmony with it, as we would expect that he would be. He was simply saying that any man who puts away his wife without a writ of divorcement, that is, a lawful breaking of the marriage contract with a lawful divorce contract, causes his wife to commit adultery if she, quote-unquote, remarries. And the one who, quote-unquote, remarries a woman not lawfully divorced also commits adultery. The King James Version finishes this verse with, "And whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery." That's even been left out by New American Standard and some of the other versions. Again, the King James finishes the verse with, "And whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery." Now, regretfully, this is the one time where the King James translators fell prey to poor translation in these particular passages. Because rather than divorced in the end of this passage, again, it's the Greek word apoluo, and it should have been, like as they did in every other case, they should have translated it put away. Thus it should read, King James verses 31 and 32, it should read in this fashion: "It has been said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say to you that whosoever shall put away his wife, that is, without a certificate of divorcement, saving for the cause of fornication, causes her to commit adultery. And whosoever shall marry her that is put away, that is, without a certificate of divorcement, committeth adultery." That's how that verse should be rendered. The King James is certainly the best, but in this particular case isn't even perfect itself. When the Greek words are translated correctly and are understood in light of God's law, what Yeshua said makes perfect sense, and is in perfect harmony with God's law, which he came to fulfill. If you don't understand or translate those words correctly, again, you're going to have Yeshua himself in contradiction to God's law, teaching something entirely different, which indeed he never did throughout his time of ministry. But someone is sure to ask, but what about the exception clause in verse 32? The exception clause, except for the case of unchastity, as rendered in the New American Standard Version. God forbid, if you use the New International Version, it really confuses matter when it renders the phrase except for marital unfaithfulness. And this is an extremely poor translation of what's actually being said there, and is very misleading, and maybe intentionally so. I don't know in that particular case, but in some cases it certainly seems that the translators of the NIV did so, some of their translating intentionally to mislead people. The King James Version renders it saving for the cause of fornication. The words unchastity and fornication are translated from the Greek word porneia. And we should ask, well, just what is porneia, or fornication or unchastity, depending on your English version? Well, rather than speculating, let's let the Bible answer that question for us. If you have a Strong's in an English, this is a hint. This is a good Bible study hint here. If you have a Strong's concordance and an Englishman's concordance, take the Strong's number for this word, number 4202 in the Greek, and then look it up in Englishman's. You don't have to know the Greek. You just look up the word from Strong's, glean the word from Strong's for this word, the Greek number, rather, and then look up that number in Englishman's, and then you can look through all the passages that use that particular number or word, no matter how it's translated, and find out how the Bible uses it. And thus you look it up, 4202, in Englishman's, and you can discover what the Bible uses this particular word to define. The first specified example, now the word is used many times without explaining what it is, but the first specified example of what porneia or fornication entails is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. You might just, as we're turning there, you might just think, well, how would I normally interpret the word or define the word fornication? What would I apply it to? Or what would the church world today apply it to? I know years ago I'd applied it to only one thing. Fornication would have meant primarily, if not exclusively, sex outside of marriage. And maybe in some cases, as in this in the passages that we're considering in the Gospels, possibly adultery. But normally, at least for me in the past, I'd have just applied it to the one thing. But is that how the Bible uses the word? Is it only exclusively used in that fashion? Well, we're going to find out in this very first example that that is not the case. The first specified example of porneia or fornication is again found in 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 1. As you were turning there, I was not, so let me get there. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 1, where it says, it is actually reported that there is immorality. King James, somebody got the King James, probably does say fornication, does it not? Okay, same word translated from porneia. It is actually reported that there is immorality or fornication among you, and immorality of such a kind as does not exist even among the heathen or Gentiles, that someone has his father's wife. What are we talking about? Incest. Are we not? So in this particular case, incest equals fornication, in harmony with God's laws found in Leviticus 18 and verses 7 and 8. We won't turn there, but in case you're recording those or want to check it out in God's law. The next New Testament example is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, starting with verse 13. It says, food is for the stomach and the stomach is for food, but God will do away with both of them. Yet the body is not for immorality or fornication, porneia, but for the Lord, and the Lord is for the body. Now God has not only raised the Lord, but will also raise us up through his power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of the Christ? Shall I then take away the members of the Christ and make them members of a harlot? May it never be. Or do you not know that the one who joins himself to a harlot is one body with her? For he says, the two will become one flesh. But the one who joins himself to the Lord is one spirit with him. Flee immorality, or fornication, porneia. Every other sin that a man commits is outside the body, but the immoral man sins against his own body. So there we have the Bible equating harlotry, or prostitution, with fornication. Same, and the next example is the same, dealing with the same thing in 1 Corinthians 10:8. We won't turn there. The next example after 1 Corinthians 10 is found in the book of Hebrews. We'll be turning there. Hebrews chapter 12. So far, we can see that fornication is defined as incest and prostitution or harlotry. Hebrews chapter 12 will be the next one, verses 15 and 16. Verse 15 says, "See to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many to be defiled." Then verse 16, most specifically, where it says, "That there be no immoral or fornicator or godless person like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal." Now, it doesn't go into detail in this New Testament passage as to what sin it was that Esau committed that was considered fornication, so we're going to have to go somewhere else. But Esau is here described as one who committed porneia. Well, just what was it that he did? There's no record of him committing incest or joining himself to prostitutes. So what was the sexual aberration that he committed? Well, let's turn to Genesis chapter 28. Genesis chapter 28, and we'll read verses 6 through 8. Verse 6, it says, "Now Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Paddan Aram, to take to himself a wife from there, and that when he blessed him, he charged him, saying, 'You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. And that Jacob had obeyed his father and his mother and gone to Paddan Aram. In verse 8, "So Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan displeased his father Isaac." Okay, let's stop right there. Now, why would the daughters of Canaan displease Isaac? And keep in mind that the Canaanites were of the same race of people. They came through Noah's son Ham. But why would they displease Isaac? We won't go into all the ramifications or the reasons here. But simply because, obviously it would appear anyway, because he knew that the Canaanites were a forbidden lineage by God for the Israelites to marry into, and thus were unlawful to marry. But that made no difference to Esau, and he took quote-unquote wives, don't miss that, I said quote-unquote wives, from amongst the Canaanite women. Now, you'll understand why I put quotes around the word wives if you don't already later on in the message. But it made no difference to him that they were forbidden lineage, and he just went ahead and did it. Turn to Genesis to prove that point. Back to Genesis chapter 27, or excuse me, that should be 26. And verses 34 and 35, last two verses of the chapter. Genesis chapter 26, verse 34. "And when Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, the daughter of Beri the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and they brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah." So it says here that he married two Hittite women. Well, who were the Hittites? Well, the Hittites were had sprang from Canaan's firstborn son, Heth. And so they were Canaanites. They were called Hittites, but they were of the Canaanite lineage, one of the Canaanite lineage known as Hittites. So Esau's porneia was joining himself to unlawful lineage. Now, in light of Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verse 2, the same would also apply to interracial unions. Reading from the King James, it says, "A bastard shall not enter into the congregation of Yahweh, even to the tenth generation shall he not enter into the congregation of Yahweh." The word bastard there is found in the King James Version, comes from the Hebrew word mamzer, and is translated simply as a mongrel, or maybe more precisely in our day and age, since that term is not necessarily politically correct or necessarily used always in the right fashion, meaning someone interracially mixed. Now, it also should be understood here that they weren't kept out of the church assembly. That's not what that word means under the Old Testament, but they were geographically segregated. They were not to come in the geographical area that Israel had. And so we can see here from this passage and some others that could be used that the same would not only apply to forbidden lineages of the same race, but also of interracial unions would be considered the same thing. What else does the New Testament describe as porneia or fornication? We want to get the full picture here. Let's turn to Jude and verse 7, since there's only one chapter. The book of Jude, just before Revelation, in verse 7, it says, "Just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they in the same way as these indulged in gross immorality," I believe the King James again renders it fornication, "and went after strange flesh, are exhibited as an example in undergoing the punishment of eternal fire." So speaking of Sodom and Gomorrah and their gross immorality or fornication, well, what was the sin that Sodom and Gomorrah were known for? Well, of course, it was inhospitality. Is that news to you? It was inhospitality. That's at least what the modern Baal ministers of queer churches are teaching. That it's inhospitality in their attempt to justify their sin. Well, if that's the case, this is the one verse that people ought to use to deal with that when they try to say that. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's a laughing matter, as one man over the phone not too long ago was telling me. He'd never heard it before. They'd gone into a homosexual church. And that's what the preacher was telling them, was the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah. It was like, how? Didn't you know that that was the sin? And all he could do was laugh. He couldn't believe that anybody could come up with that one. But if you want a scripture that deals with it, use Jude verse 7. Because if that's the case, then anyone who would marry an inhospitable person is guilty of fornication. Of this gross fornication. So of course, their argument wouldn't work to begin with, but this one will certainly clinch it for them. Of course, we know that the sin described by Jude as gross immorality or fornication, and by the way, the only sin that's so described in the Bible, not that there aren't others who God would consider the same, but this is the only sin that's so described. Others are described as porneia. This one is described as extra porneia. Homosexuality. You wonder why some people react to homosexuals in a much stronger way than they do adulterers. And sometimes we, our conscience maybe will allow for an adulterer. We won't allow for the homosexual, and it shouldn't be that way. But there is a reason why we're more, what's the word I want? More intolerant, or there's a stronger word to homosexuality. Even God's word describes it as extra fornication, extra porneia. So there's a reason for it. That's for extra. I found that interesting. Originally, I thought it was the wrong word. It wasn't even the right word to prove what fornication was. No, this word means extra fornication in God's sight, extra perverse. Well, we know that what it was homosexuality. Thus, we can conclude that homosexuality is also a form of fornication. Now, there is at least one other sexual perversion dealt with in the law, and although not specifically addressed in the New Testament, I think as porneia or fornication, I think we would all agree is also a form of fornication, and that is sex with animals or what's known as bestiality. Leviticus chapter 20 and verses 15 and 16 makes it very clear. It says, "If there is a man who lies with an animal, he shall surely be put to death. You shall also kill the animal. If there is a woman who approaches any animal to mate with it, you shall kill the woman and the animal, and they shall surely be put to death. Their blood guiltness is upon them." Again, it's not specifically addressed in the New Testament. And for those New Testament Christians who say the only part of the law that's retained is those that are specifically mentioned in the New Testament, this is really going to give them some problems. Because if that theology is correct, then they have to admit that bestiality is also correct or permissible under the New Covenant age. Simply not the case. They've got a misunderstanding of the application of God's law. But here we can see, I think we'd agree, that bestiality is also fornication or porneia. Also, according to Deuteronomy 24, verses 4 through 1 through 4, remarrying a divorced wife after she was remarried and divorced a second time, I think should probably also be considered as fornication. At the very least, it was considered an abomination to God, if you go back and read those passages, doing so. And I think it should be considered as porneia as well. Also, according to the New Testament, quote-unquote, marrying a woman not properly or lawfully divorced from her present husband would also fit the description of porneia, because porneia or fornication needs to be understood, according to what we've seen thus far, as simply unlawful sexual relationships. It's just not sex outside of marriage. The following list would represent what the Old and New Testament alike depict as porneia or fornication, as we've just seen: incest, prostitution, forbidden lineage relationships, interracial relationships, homosexuality, bestiality, remarriage to a previous wife who's been divorced a second time, and quote-unquote marriage to unlawfully divorced women. Those are the things that we know, and maybe there are some others that I haven't come up with in this message, that are considered, at least those we know, are considered as porneia or fornication. Now, with this understanding, let's see if we can't correctly understand, the exception clause found in Matthew chapter 5. Now, keep in mind that Yeshua in verse 32 is not speaking about divorce. That's sometimes hard to even get out of our minds, but we've got to program our minds now to see this differently. He is not speaking of divorce. The Greek word apostasion is not even found in the two verses. But instead, or rather, he's speaking of putting away without a certificate of divorce. So let's first read these two verses as they should have been translated, and then let's also read into this passage what we now know are cases of porneia. And see if it doesn't make sense. Matthew 5, verse 30, beginning with verse 31. I'll just read them to you. Listen. And it was said, whoever puts away his wife, puts away, that is, without a certificate of divorce, in this case it should be just, and it was said, whoever puts away his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. Verse 32, but I say to you that everyone who puts away his wife, that is, without a certificate of divorce, except for the cause of unchastity, i.e. cases of incest, prostitution, forbidden lineage or interracial unions, homosexuality, bestiality, etc., makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a put-away, that is, woman without a certificate of divorce, commits adultery himself. Now, therein you have the proper rendition, proper translation, and interpretation of those passages. Now, it still may not be exactly clear. So let me put it to you in layman terms, if you will. In other words, a man may not put away his mate without a certificate of divorce unless it's an incestual relationship or one with a prostitute or a forbidden lineage or interracial relationship or one with someone of the same sex or an animal, or one with a wife previously divorced, remarried and divorced a second time, or one with a woman unlawfully divorced. Now note, I called these relationships not marriages for a reason. Because in God's eyes, none of those relationships in that exception clause, none of those relationships constitute a lawful marriage. You know, we've got homosexuals today. In some states where ministers or justices of the peace are performing marriages. That's not a marriage at all. It's just a relationship, an ungodly relationship. And so that's what it needs to be called. They're not marriages. And that is why a man could put away these partners without having to provide them with a certificate of divorce. In other words, he was saying, it is wrong to put away your lawful wife without a certificate of divorce. But it's not wrong to put away someone of an ancestral relationship, a homosexual relationship, a forbidden lineage relationship, so forth and so on, without a certificate of divorce. In these cases, it wasn't required because there was no lawful marriage contract that required annulment with a divorce certificate. These kinds of relationships only required repenting and the putting away of the unlawful partner. And God has even provided for us a biblical example of such a separation. Turn with me, if you would, to Ezra chapter 10. Ezra chapter 10, and I'm going to go ahead and just read the rest of these passages as I get to them because I think we might run short on time here. Ezra 10, beginning with verse 1, it says, "Now while Ezra was praying and making confession, weeping and prostrating himself before the house of God, a very large assembly, men, women, and children, gathered to him from Israel, for the people wept bitterly. And Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, one of the sons of Elam, answered and said to Ezra, 'We have been unfaithful to our God and have married...'" Now, if you have the New American Standard, look at the footnote. It says, "given dwelling to." They hadn't married them. They even understood they'd simply given dwelling to these women. "And have given dwelling to foreign women from the people of the land. Yet now there is hope for Israel in spite of this. So now let us make a covenant with our God to put away all the wives and their children according to the counsel of my Lord and of those who tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to the law." Now, the word translated "put away," you should know, in this particular case, is not the same Hebrew word for "put away" as used in Deuteronomy chapter 24. However, it is employed in the same fashion or the same sense. Go to verse 10 now. "Then Ezra the priest stood up and said to them, 'You have been unfaithful and have married,'" or given, King James says taken, by the way, "'or given dwelling to foreign wives, adding to the guilt of Israel.'" The word "wives" there doesn't necessarily even have to be translated as wives either, but simply women. "Now therefore," verse 11, "make confession to Yahweh, God of your fathers, and do His will, and separate yourselves from the peoples of the land and from the foreign wives." Now, just as a writ of divorcement was not necessary to separate from the people of the land, neither was it needed for the Israelites to put away these women whom they had been unlawfully cohabiting with. And so there was no certificate of divorce mentioned or needed. Why? Because these relationships had never been considered lawful marriages in the first place. And thus it didn't need a lawful contract to end it or annul it. Why? Jump back to chapter 9 and verse 1. Ezra 9, verse 1, it says, "Now when these things had been completed, the princes approached me, saying, 'The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands, according to their abominations, those of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. For they had taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy race has intermingled with the peoples of the lands. Indeed, the hands of the princes and the rulers have been foremost in this unfaithfulness.'" But first, verse 1 most specifically, with every people cited in that particular verse, we're talking about either Canaanites, Moabites, or Ammonites. Sometimes specifically named, and in other cases, you can trace them back. The Egyptians would maybe raise an eyebrow or two, but we know that the Egyptians are considered Hamites in one or two books of the Psalms. And in this particular case, it would have had to have been the Canaanite line because it was the only forbidden line. Otherwise, they could marry into the other Hamite lines. And so in every case, we're talking about Canaanites, Ammonites, and Moabites, all of which were lineages that God had forbid Israel to intermarry with. And thus, since He had forbid it, they were unlawful. Thus, in this instance, it was only necessary that they repent of their sins and put their foreign wives away. Consequently, nowhere in this particular situation do we find a certificate of divorce required or used. As back to Ezra chapter 10 and verses, beginning with verse 12, it says, "Then all the assembly answered and said with a loud voice, 'That's right. As you have said, so it is our duty to do. But there are many people. It is the rainy season, and we're not able to stand in the open. Nor can the task be done in one or two days, for we have transgressed greatly in this matter. Let our leaders represent the whole assembly, and let all those in our cities who have married foreign wives come at appointed times together with the elders and judges of each city until the fierce anger of our God on account of this matter is turned away from us. Jump down to verse 16. But the exiles did so, and Ezra the priest selected men who were heads of the fathers' households for each of their fathers' households, all of them by name. So they convened on the first day of the 10th month to investigate the matter. And they finished investigating all the men who had married foreign wives, or given them dwelling, by the first of the first month. And among the sons of the priest who had married foreign wives were found of the sons of Jeshua, the son of Jehozadak, and his brothers Maaseiah, Eleazar, Jerob, and Gedaliah. Verse 19, and they pledged to put away their wives, not divorce them, not give them a certificate of divorce, but to simply put away their wives, and being guilty, they offered a ram of the flock for their offense. It really couldn't be any clearer. And in this particular, God did provide us indeed a perfect example of what Yeshua was dealing with in Matthew chapter 5. That there was no certificate of divorce or writ of divorce necessary when the marriage was unlawful in God's sight to begin with, which it would be with incest, bestiality, homosexuality, interracial, or forbidden lineage unions, or the others that I mentioned. It simply would not be necessary. I need to get rolling. Thus, the correct translation and understanding of the key words in Matthew 5 in light of God's law, we can now understand what Yeshua was saying in this and similar New Testament passages. And I suggest that if you're using a translation other than the King James, that you cross out the word divorce in Matthew chapter 5 in verses 31 and 32 and replace it with put away as it should have been. And also, in the very latter part of verse 32, even in the King James Version, that you would also replace the word divorce there with the word put away. Let's move on, and we'll cover as much of this as we can. Hopefully we'll get through it. But Matthew chapter 19. Matthew chapter 19, beginning with verse 3. It says, and some Pharisees came to him, testing him, and saying, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause at all? Now, is that what the Pharisees were asking him? If they were, then they would have had to have used the Greek word apostasion. However, that is not the word that they used. Instead, they used the Greek word apoluo. As the King James renders it, they asked him if it was lawful for a man to put away his wife for any cause. You see, their deception was even greater than it first appeared, as I mentioned in the first message. The argument could be made from Deuteronomy chapter 24 that a man could divorce his wife for any just cause, but he certainly could not put away his wife for any cause. As a matter of fact, it was for that very reason, at least it would appear or seem, or for that very hardened heart attitude, if you will, that the Pharisees were displaying that Yahweh provided for divorcement. Now, although the law did provide for divorce, Yeshua obviously in his answer wanted to put it in its proper perspective, and thus his initial answer as found in verses 4 through 6. And he answered and said, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Consequently, they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. He puts the emphasis where it should be. As a result of Yahshua's answer and his avoiding their trap, the Pharisees were then forced to get more specific with their question, verse 7, and actually more scriptural. Verse 7, it says, and then they said to him, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate and divorce her? The King James adds to the end of this verse, or I should say, the NASV, the New American Standard Version, subtracted from the end of this verse what the King James Version retained from the Greek manuscripts, that is, and to put her away. That should be on the end of that verse if you're not using the King James Version. So the whole verse would read, then they said to him, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate and divorce her and to put her away? A direct reference to Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verse 1. I believe that the New American Standard translators subtracted the last part of this verse because they had already previously, quote-unquote, translated apaluo as divorce in verse 3. And since it is also found in this verse, verse 7, in order to be consistent, they would have had to have done so again in verse 7. And then the verse would have absolutely made no sense. Because here's how verse 7 would have read if they had retained the last part of this verse and had translated apaluo as divorce as they had in verse 3. It would read this way, "And they said to him, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate and divorce her?" See, it would simply have been redundance. And so they just avoided the last part of the verse. Let's now look at Yeshua's answer, beginning with verse 8. Verse 8 he says, "And he said to them, because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it has not been this way." Take your pen, if you've got a New American Standard or some other version, cross out divorce, it should have been put away. Now, in this instance, at least in this verse, in answering their specific question, in reference to Deuteronomy 24, Yeshua does use the term put away to describe the whole divorce process, which, of course, culminated in the putting away. So he does use the term in that fashion. But then in verse 9, he returns to the same discussion and instructions as we found him giving in Matthew chapter 5. That is, a woman put away without a certificate of divorcement. Verse 9, he says, "And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, puts away his wife, except for immorality or fornication, and marries another woman, commits adultery." The King James retains the following at the end of this verse, which again is not found in the New American Standard, which says, "And whosoever marries her which is put away," obviously without a certificate of divorce, doth commit adultery. Now, in light of the clarity of Matthew chapter 5, verses 31 and 32, the same interpretation should be applied here in verse 9 as well. Or, once again, Yeshua would be caught changing the law, which indeed he never did. He himself, by his own words, came to keep the law, to fulfill the law, not to abolish it. In Mark 10, verses 2 through 12, we find essentially the same discussion as in Matthew 19. So if you're using something other than the King James Version, I would suggest that you use the King James Version as a guide and replace divorce with put away where it should have been translated as such. The same in Luke 16 and verse 18. Rather than being everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, and he who marries one who is divorced from a husband commits adultery, it should be everyone who puts away his wife and marries another commits adultery, and he who marries one who is put away from a husband commits adultery. So I'd suggest that you go and change those versions, or as you read them in the future, you still probably will not be able to understand them correctly. Now, hopefully, and I know this has been rather detailed, and you may want even the tape to go back and really understand what's being said, but now hopefully this will clear up what has been mistranslated and misinterpreted for who knows how long. Hopefully it will also remove unnecessary guilt from those who have been divorced and remarried, which the church has heaped upon untold hundreds and hundreds of people that have divorced and remarried. God's law does not promote it, but it does permit it. And that's what needs to be understood.
This tape was produced by Mission to Israel Ministries. For more information regarding this ministry, or for a list of books and tapes available through this ministry, write Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scottsbluff, Nebraska, 69363.